This is Charudas, welcoming one and all to Bhagavad Gita As It Is, study sessions. We've advanced in our sessions to the concluding chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. It's the 18th chapter. It's entitled The Perfection of Renunciation. Last time we talked about the 5th verse in the 18th chapter, and I would like to dwell on that verse for yet another session. I'll read the Sanskrit, the English, and then we'll discuss it. Yagyadana tapakama natyajam kayam eva tat yagyodana tapaschaiva bhavanani manisanam. Translation: acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance are not to be given up. They must be performed. Indeed, sacrifice, charity, and penance purify even the great souls. We'll be back in a moment. If God is indeed a person, as we're saying over and over and over and over again, then when one becomes God-realized, it stands to reason that he needs no further instruction. He doesn't have to follow any more rules and regulations, because all rules and regulations, all instructions, are meant to bring him to the summum bonum of life, the highest platform of perfection. Having achieved that, of course, then those rules and regulations cease to have any value. God is a person. He confirms that when one realizes him, that person gets all knowledge, all potency that he needs directly from its original source, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Tejam satidam yuktanam bhajatam piti purvakam. For those who constantly worship me in love and devotion, Lord Krishna says, dadami buddhi yogam tam. Yenamam abhyandite. I give them the understanding by which they come to me. God is the reservoir of all knowledge. And if one comes into contact with God in a tangible, pure-hearted way, then of course there is no knowledge to which he does not have access. God promises that through his devotee he will illuminate that person. I, seated within his heart, illuminate his heart and destroy the darkness of ignorance, just like a transcendental torch. But what about those who have not come to a full, mature realization of the Supreme Personality of God? And what about those who don't realize the Lord, who have never seen him face to face? What is their position? Do they have duties? Are they to follow instructions? What should they do? Should they renounce, throw everything overboard in order to live as a madman, wandering here and there, chanting Hare Krishna, go to the Himalayas, meditate on their navels, lie on a bed of nails? What are they to do? Over and over and over and over in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna tells people who are on the lower stages of devotional advancement that they should go on doing just exactly what they're doing. Because if you are executing certain responsibilities, be they familial, national, or social, religious, or economic, the point is that these things should not be given up. In the 60s, as I've several times mentioned, young people thought, or they equated renunciation of middle-class values, background, and opulence, they equated that with spiritual advancement. But far from being spiritually advanced, far from becoming spiritually advanced when they walked out of their middle-class houses, they became totally degraded. They became even more animalistic and ignorant than they were before. So the result of artificial renunciation is hippiedom. It is hippiedom. And a hippie is an unhappy person who basically suffers from lack of direction, a lack of knowledge. One should, and Krishna stresses over and over and again, continue with what he's doing. There are only four occupational duties which will block all spiritual advancement. If you're engaged in any one of these four occupational duties, it's very difficult to make spiritual advancement, because these are sinful activities, and sin and piety do not go well together. If one is involved in the meat industry, if he's involved in intoxication, illicit sex, gambling, if he's either partaking of intoxication himself or he's involved in the advertising or distribution of those items, Then great sin occurs to him, cloud, a dark cloud of ignorance comes and settles into his mind. It's not, of course, that one necessarily, if he finds himself in these occupations and with a simultaneous interest in Krishna consciousness, it's not that we necessarily demand that he give up his occupation overnight and with no prospect of even getting the food on the table tomorrow for him and his family. Everything has to be done intelligently. But if one is becoming God consciousness, and at the same time he's getting his livelihood from those two, meat eating or intoxication, and also illicit sex or gambling, then he should immediately formulate a plan whereby he can gradually give up that occupational duty in favor of something which is more honest and more pure. It's not going to be difficult, but a plan can be made. I mean, it's not going to be easy. For instance, I have a gentleman friend. You may have heard this story on our interview hour show. I've interviewed a couple of times a man named Pranjeevan Bhopa. He came from Uganda. He was a victim of Idi Amin's persecutions. He had 7 days to leave the country. Naturally, his considerable fortune, which is held in the bank, was confiscated, and he came penniless to America. And with some loans from some friends, he, for $10,000, he bought a little shop in the ground floor of a multi-story office building downtown L.A. And before he bought the premises, the biggest seller was beef burritos. The previous owner had made a substantial portion of his profits from selling beef burritos. And at the time our friend bought the shop, he had no scruples about selling beef. He hadn't had any contact with the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. Although he was Indian, he'd never been to India. He was an Indian from Africa or Uganda. And he started coming to the temple and bringing his family and learning the higher values of spiritual life. And one of them, of course, is nonviolence, especially towards our mother, the cow. So he began, as he would go to work every day, to feel more and more guilty about being involved in the selling of beef products. And then finally it came to a crisis, and he came into the temple one Sunday afternoon, and he stood before the deity. Now this was a drastic giving up on his part, but yet I just want to mention this because it exemplifies how the Lord in fact protects someone who's sincere. He came before the deity. He said, "My dear Lord Krishna, I'm going to, when I open my shop tomorrow morning, I'm not going to have any beef or chicken or any other meat burritos for sale. And when someone comes up and requests that, I'm going to explain why I'm not selling these things. And I know that my income will drop at least by half. My only request is that you please don't let me and my family starve." So he did that. He stopped the selling of any meat products. He explained to people why he was doing that. And strangely enough, people appreciated and accepted his explanations. Of course, they began to go somewhere else for their lunches, their meat lunches, but they didn't stop going to his shop for juice and cupcakes and chewing gum and things like that. If anything, he got more patrons, more people who were impressed with his moral and ethical stance began to patronize his shop, buy their newspapers there, etc., etc. Not only did he not starve, but now, 7 years later, his business is worth $60,000. He bought it for $10,000, and even without selling a single beef burrito in the last 5 or 6 years, the value of that business he's been offered $60,000 should he want to sell it today. So that's an exemplary case. It's not possible, perhaps, for everyone to jettison their livelihood in such an abrupt way, but a plan should be made. One should train to earn his livelihood in a less sinful manner. So, in any case, an aspiring devotee will not be involved either personally in eating meat or distributing meat, either personally in taking intoxications, including coffee, tea, and cigarettes, advertising or selling these items, either personally involved in illicit sex or promoting it. Now, no one promotes overtly illicit sex. You don't see any billboards that say, you know, have illicit sex. But indirectly, of course, every advertiser promotes it because every sellable commodity that you see advertised almost invariably has a half-naked woman lying beside it. So the overtones are very highly sexual. They agitate the senses to the point that, practically speaking, people are push towards illicit sex and promiscuity just because of overexposure to women who are used to sell products. Then finally, gambling, racetrack, and dog races, etc., etc. Otherwise, Krishna says, go, if you're now presently earning your livelihood from any other activity than these four things, by all means, don't give it up. It's good for you to go to work every day at the same time, to discipline oneself, to live a regulated life, to raise a family. These things should never be given up. Rather, they are to be accepted because indirectly they promote the cause of God consciousness. And of course, one can directly transform his family life and his life at the office in various ways into an entirely spiritual activity. We have many life members, Indian members, who are vice presidents of big corporations, who are highly placed engineers in Bechtel, Braun, Parsons, Rockwell International, Hughes Aircraft, Northrop Engineering. And they are open, they're alert to any time that any of their underlings or employees ask them about their religion or about their diet. They just come straight out and preach straight Krishna consciousness from the Bhagavad Gita. So preaching is going on, not just by the shaven-headed robed monks, but it is going on in Hughes, Northrop, and many 20th century Fox. Wherever we find our life members and devotees, they take the opportunity, when asked, to deliver the message of Krishna consciousness. So these institutions are never meant to be given up. The most spiritual of all institutions is called Brahmachari, and that basically literally means celibate student. In Vedic times, there was no intermingling of boys and girls in the early teenage years, because when boys and girls reach the age of puberty, there's a great overwhelming attraction, boy for girl, girl for boy. And whenever there's free intermingling of the boys and girls, then of course one's mind becomes distracted from getting the education that he should be getting in those early years, at least up until the age of 25 for the boy and 16 for the girl. His mind should not become distracted. Woman is sometimes compared to fire, and the man is compared to butter. When fire comes close to butter, butter begins to melt. So in the educational institution, the men and women learn separately because we want to keep things cool. We want to keep things cool. So that is the celibate student life. And even in India today, if you go, you'll see those celibate students who always wear saffron. People ask, why do you wear saffron? Those who wear saffron are celibate students. They are either young fellows before the age of 25, or they are old men after the age of 50, those who wear saffron. Generally speaking, the saffron worn on the body of the young person means that he's a celibate student. He may get married later, but right now he's dedicating himself to studies and celibacy. The saffron-robed oldster, who is over the age of 50, you'll generally see him not only wearing the saffron robe, but also carrying a staff, a three-headed staff called a tridanda. And that means that he has formally taken a vow of renunciation. He has left enough wealth or whatever to provide for his wife and family, but he has left them in order to dedicate himself to study and travel and preaching and austerities. Basically, he's weaning himself from this world. He's preparing to die and to hopefully get a better position in the next world. That's the sannyasi. So all these different institutions were there formerly, and they were called varnashram dharma. Varna means a class, or as it's come to be known today, a caste. And dharma means truth. So varnashram dharma was a way of organizing the society so that people could gradually be elevated through stages up to the platform of God consciousness. Now, after the brahmachari years, the first 25 years of one's life, the young man would have the option at the age of 24, 25 to get married. And if he chose to get married, then he would be called a grihastha. He would marry, have children. Now, the grihastha ashram, ashram means, again, a level of society from which one can make spiritual advancement. So the householders of former times didn't have the same value systems as householders have today. When one gets married today, according to Marshall's rule of economics, he simply becomes inspired by the association of the opposite sex and being surrounded by children of his own making. He becomes inspired to accumulate more and more and more and more unlimited material goods. He has basically no other ethic, no other overriding ethic than this, to become more and more and more opulent and to leave as much money to the family as he can at the time of death. But the actual grihastha ashram, householder ashram, is meant to purify one. So no one can become purified if he adheres to the ethic of making more and more and more money at whatever cost. That is simply not a mentality that will lead to purification. The grihastras would make money, or they would raise cows, they would produce some wealth in some way or another, but then they would give that wealth in charity. Rather than hoarding, rather than claiming all this as their property, as coming as a result of the sweat of their brow, what they would do is they would support in charity the celibate brahmacharis and the retired sannyasis. You see what I mean? So the one section of society would support the other two sections of society in charity. And they would consider that by giving for the maintenance of the brahmacharis and the sannyasis, that they would get a lot of spiritual benefit. Because after all, don't forget, they're men with families, they have responsibilities, they have to make money. They don't have much time for purely spiritual activities like chanting and going to classes and things like that. That's not to say that they can't spiritually purify themselves. If they see the fruit of the results of their work as not belonging to them, but as coming their way due to the mercy of the Supreme Lord, and if they take a significant proportion of their profits and cycle it back into the process of increasing God consciousness, supporting the institution of brahmachari, supporting the institution of sannyasi, then he will make as much spiritual advancement as any brahmachari, any sannyasi. Now, on their part, the brahmacharis and sannyasis don't go around begging alms just so they can have a big bank balance. They go around begging for just what they need, rice or whatever. And if the householder is generous to the point of giving them more than what they need, either in terms of foodstuffs or money, they find some way to spend this for the propagation of God consciousness. One time there was a great sacrifice performed in olden days, and the king was so fabulously wealthy that he gave to all the Brahmins who assisted in the performance of the sacrifice, he all gave them many, many gold utensils. And he gave them mules also, by which they could carry these gold utensils out of the Himalayas where the sacrifice was being performed into, you know, India proper. So each Brahmin went away. The Brahmins, they didn't, what am I going to do with this gold? Yellow stool, they saw it. What do I need gold for? They had no material aspiration. But they didn't want to be impolite. They didn't want to decline the gifts of the king. So they accepted the gold, loaded it all up on the banks of the donkeys. But then as they were wending their way through the mountain passes, coming into the lowlands of India, gradually once they got around the corner and the king wasn't looking anymore, they just took the gold and tossed it away. And so much gold was tossed away by these Brahmins that there was an entire mountain of gold created. And thousands of years later, Maharaj Yudhisthira, the eldest of the five Pandava brothers, and Lord Krishna were sitting around trying to figure out how Yudhisthira would get enough wealth to perform the Rajasuya Yagga, the Rajasuya sacrifice. Raja means king. Rajasuya is the king of all sacrifices, and as such, it requires the greatest amount of wealth to perform. Lord Krishna hit upon the idea, hey, what about the gold which was thrown away several hundreds of years ago by these Brahmins? The gold was still sitting there, and they organized an expedition to go to the Himalayas to get this gold, bring it down, and that was what financed the Rajasuya sacrifice of Yudhisthira. The point is that the Brahmins, they go around begging from door to door, not for their own personal wealth, just for their maintenance, and if they get an excess of wealth, they either reject it altogether, or they use it better than rejecting it, better than what these Brahmins did, throwing it by the side of the road, is to use it in God's service. Devotees sometimes approach people in airports and parking lots, and some people characterize this as begging. Well, in one sense, it is. It teaches humility. It is an essential part of civilized life for a young man, even if he's the son of a king or the son of a rich man, to learn the art of humility. He should not become swell-headed because of the family that he's taken birth in. And formerly, everyone went to the ashram of the spiritual master, and everyone learned how to perform menial tasks on behalf of the spiritual master. And the most standard task of all would be to go out with your bowl and beg alms on behalf of the spiritual master, to come back and to give those alms to the spiritual master. And the qualification of the spiritual master is he who knows how to maintain his ashram on a spiritual platform, and if there's excess money, how to spend that in such a way as to spread God consciousness among the people in general. So in this way, you had your various orders of life. They were all very, very purificatory. Lord Krishna enjoins again and again and again, do not give up these various duties, do not give up these various ashrams. But of course, in the modern age, all these traditional ashrams, rules, regulations, and institutions have gone by the wayside. And what are we to do? The big question arises, what institution, what rules and regulations are we to follow in this day and age when everything is topsy-turvy? And the answer, which I'll elaborate more upon in the next class, is to perform that one great sacrifice, to do that one great activity in the performance of which everything else is automatically completed. And that is the sacrifice of the chanting of the holy names of God. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Just by doing this one supreme activity, it's considered that a man has undergone brahmachari life, undergone the giving and charity, done all sacrifices necessary to be done, and he is said to be the best of the Aryan family. The reason being that he has realized that activity which is the quintessence of life. It is to glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead from whom all good things come.
You've been listening to commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Bhagavad Gita is the essence of India's Vedic wisdom and one of the great spiritual and philosophical classics of the world. The ultimate conclusion of the Gita is unconditional loving surrender unto Lord Krishna, which frees one from all sins, bringing one to complete enlightenment and enables one to return to Krishna's eternal spiritual abode.